therein are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
Problems, problems, problems all day long. Will my problems work out right or wrong? My baby don't like anything I do. My teacher seems to feel the same way too.
Good morning, Fairbanks. You are listening to KFAR Radio. We are at 660 on the AM dial, 97.5 on the FM dial, and we live stream at kfarradio.com. This is Problem Corner. I'm your host, David Pruz. If you want to call into today's show, we're at 907-458-TALK. That's 907-458-8255. And with that, it's the third Wednesday, which means
we have Nick Nugent with Alaska History.
And today's Alaska History is?
We're talking about Nova Rupta, the great event which created the Valley of 10,000 Smokes.
Oh, man. Okay.
I thought it'd be interesting maybe to do an event. We've done people a lot.
You know, most people don't realize where the 10,000 Smokes is in the Aleutians.
No, it's
Alaska Peninsula there.
Yeah, it's kind of north of Kodiak Island.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that we'll find interesting here. It was so remote at the time that probably the third largest volcanic event in recorded history.
And no one witnessed it.
Caused no deaths also.
Oh, yeah.
And there were some witnesses there. We'll talk about the Dora, a mail boat that realized something was going seriously wrong.
Yeah.
Well, this was 114 years ago this June. They were the 20th century's most voluminous event. Much of the early descriptions come from Robert Fisk Griggs, and he wrote for the National Geographic. A lot of his writings are online, so if somebody would like to go more into depth than what we will today, you can look those up. The others that are good to look up are some of the USGS reports. And they are all available online. Just look up USGS old publications. If you Google that, you'll see the site. And you can. They're all PDFs. They're easy to download. So there's a lot of fun. Now, those are fairly scientific papers.
Yeah.
They, you know, if you want to know about rhyolites and so forth, that's the place to go. If that's not so interesting, there still is a good history section in each one of those and descriptions of the event. There was a later account, which is available. Wes Hildreth and Judy Fairstein had a work published by the USGS, and it was called The Eruptive History of Mount Katmai, Alaska. That's a very good one. They put together a nice timeline. Well, the site then is known as Nova Rupta, which new eruption. It's in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes, and there were two overlapping cones with separate craters and vents. The eruptive volume is estimated to be as much as 13.5 cubic miles.
Okay.
Now, I tried to figure that out. You know, my brain, try to wrap my brain around it. And if we took Fairbanks from the Chena River to Pegger to Van Horn, back up Cushman, and 2,500 feet deep and blew it into the sky.
That's it.
That's it. So you can just imagine the volume of ash and rock that was thrown up. There were three main explosive events, and based on seismic records, the eruptions lasted for about 60 hours with 14 earthquakes of a magnitude of 6 to 7, and the collapse of the caldera started in the 11th hour. In total, 50 earthquakes were recorded at distant stations. Three peaks measured by the USGS prior to 1910, they're only known by their elevations above sea level, and that was 7,500, 7,360, and 7,260. They're gone. They were totally obliterated. And just, Remember the pictures of Mount St. Helens?
Yeah.
Well, if you can imagine that happening on a scale where everything in the video, not just Mount, but out to the sides,
is gone,
went just like that, that's a lot of what you would have seen. At that time, there were no observers nearby, no aircraft in Alaska, so the eruption narrative was a lot of it assembled from scattered villages and ship reports. Volcanology in those days was actually in its infancy. The early investigations, 1915 to 1923, were basically very arduous expeditions. Many misapprehensions were included in the reports because of what they did not really understand yet.
Yeah.
So the field work, though, stopped in 23, was not resumed until 1953, which was a lapse of 30 years. But in that time, the advances in physical volcanology and chemical petrology have really allowed in-depth studies that tell us quite a bit of what happened. The clarification of the sequence of events has been done. And it's probably one of the best studied eruptions in the world. The professional paper that the two authors wrote that I mentioned, USGS Professional Paper 1791, said it was to provide perspective on this century-long evolution. And that's what they've done. They've done a very nice job. So what could have been kind of an unknown event, like when one of the South Sea Islands exploded.
Yeah.
Because it was in Alaska and people were interested, then there's been a lot of follow-up.
Studies, yeah.
Well, everything that we'll talk about will be time cited as local Alaska time during 1912. I want to remember we had five time zones then. If there's uncertainties, discrepancies, or yarns, they've tried to weed some of those out. And the primary sources are largely Perry from 1912, Martin in 1913, and they both went and interviewed a lot of the eyewitnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the geographic setting, it's the Alaska Peninsula. It's 466-mile-long arm that dominates southwestern Alaska, extends southwest into the Aleutians. Probably the last, maybe Naknek would be one of the towns out that way. King Salmon now, mm-hmm, at the Air Force Station. And then Bethel and Dillingham on the north side of Bristol Bay. Well, Nova Rupta then is 280 miles southwest of Anchorage, 106 miles west-northwest of Kodiak, and 60 miles east-southeast of King Salmon, which is the nearest year-round town, King Salmon Naknek.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that, of the 120-mile-long reach of the peninsula from Cape Douglas to Bekaroff Lake, lies now within Katmai National Park. So that's kind of interesting, too, because it is the national park. There have been studies of the area encouraged, and I believe there's not very, I know a number of students from UAF, volcanologists, who have been out and part of different parties, so it's still ongoing.
Okay.
Well, the lowlands are, the area is basically treeless in the high country, or limited to species resistant to cold, wind, and desiccation, being really frozen. The lowlands, spruce forests are widespread with alder, willow, grasses, sedges, and balsam poplar. So not too, in the lowlands, not too different from here. Mammals are all of those found in the interior, and at the coast one will add in seals, sea lions, sea otters, and gray whales. And just quickly, we can look at the world in 1912. Alaska wasn't very well known yet.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
It has occurred to me that I am an introvert. I live a sheltered life as an old septic tank. gazing at the stars, pondering my poetry, appreciating the weather, rain or snow. I know my family has Bigfoot Pumpin' and Thawin' faithfully pump me out once a year. I count on that flow in my life, and I will continue to serve them much better for many years to come.
Did your vehicle survive 145 days of sub-zero temperatures this winter? If so, it deserves a participation trophy. Months of torture on your vehicle's systems like suspension, brakes, and fluids really takes a toll. Spring into action with Glacier Garage and bring your rig in for the maintenance it deserves. At Glacier Garage, our technicians will inspect the key systems winter loves to punish and make sure your car is ready for the roads ahead. Don't wait for a small issue to become a costly repair. Call Glacier Garage or find us online at glaciergarage.com. And after this winter, we all deserve a participation trophy.
Far-left anti-Alaska groups have been falsely attacking Senator Dan Sullivan. These lower 48 liberals want to crush Alaska's economy and destroy our jobs. Senator Sullivan is the only thing standing between us and them. That's why they're spending millions in dark money to smear Dan and his record. Here are the facts. For 30 years, Dan Sullivan served our country honorably as a Marine Corps infantry officer. As our senator, Dan has expanded energy production, protected our Second Amendment, secured historic investments in Alaska healthcare, and led the fight against domestic violence. He's improved Alaska's aviation safety and helped our youth overcome mental health and addiction challenges. Dan has rebuilt Alaska's military and Coast Guard and delivered the icebreakers we need. A Marine, a family man, a highly effective senator, a fighter for Alaska jobs and our people. Dan delivers for Alaska.
I'm Dan Sullivan, and I approve this message.
Paid for by Alaskans for Dan Sullivan.
Weather brought to you by Great Harvest Bread Company. Biscuits, bagels, and sandwiches so good you need them. Skip the snooze. Your breakfast is waiting for you at Great Harvest at the corner of Airport Way and Wilbur.
KFAR Weather.
Cloudy skies expected today with a slight chance of rain showers. Daytime highs approaching 63. Southeast winds around 5 miles an hour. Cloudy skies expected again tonight. Chance of rain showers. Lows dip down to about 45. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Derek Height.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back in the studio here with Nick Nugent. We're discussing the volcanic event of 1912.
And it was just an amazing thing. You know, if this something like this happened today, we would have 24/7 news coverage of everything that was ongoing. And back then, it basically took till the ash cloud got somewhere for people to realize, oh, wonder what happened.
Well, true.
If we look at 1912, by that time, there had been some military explorations. The Coast and Geodetic Survey, the Western Union, which we covered here once, the USGS. And by 1912, commercial fishing, canneries, and fur trapping were overtaking marine mammals. Marine mammals were pretty well on the downside from all of the hunting that took place from the 1700s to this time.
Yeah.
Alaska's population was about 50,000 in 1912, 30,000 of whom had arrived since the gold rush of 1898 to 1900. Alaska was reorganized as an incorporated territory that year, roughly halfway between purchase and statehood. The SS Dora was operating. We'll talk about the Dora a bit more. Served coastal villages from Unalaska to Valdez for several decades, occasionally ran as far south as Sitka and Seattle, transporting mail, supplies, fishing, mining equipment, passengers, cattle. And she played a very key role in reporting this 1912 eruption. The automobile wasn't common, but the first Model T had started operating between Valdez and Fairbanks in 1908. In 1912, the United States issued its first postage stamp picturing an airplane. In April, the Titanic hit an iceberg and sank in the North Atlantic, so it was kind of a busy year. Politics, New Mexico was admitted as the 47th state, Arizona as the 48th. Woodrow Wilson was elected president, beating Theodore Roosevelt and incumbent William Howard Taft and Eugene V. Debs, a lot of candidates that year. Three of the four main candidates advocated political and social reform, antitrust legislation, and more direct democracy. So it doesn't sound an awful lot different from now.
No, it does not.
Popular culture.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
They absolutely do. In popular culture, the Oreo was introduced that year.
Thank God.
You bet. What a
Who didn't grow up with an Oreo cookie?
Absolutely. Now, there's a volcanic event.
Yeah. The Hydrox.
Tarzan, Lord of the Apes, was first published. L.L. Bean opened their first store in Freeport, Maine, and Fenway Park opened. In science, Robert Falcon Scott arrived on foot at the South Pole on the 17th of January, found the tent of Roald Amundsen, who had reached the pole on skis 35 days earlier. And the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory was formally opened on the rim of Kilauea Caldera. So there again, that was our first volcanic observatory. Unfortunately, Hawaii was a bit away. Some of the chronology of firsthand reports comes from the Dora. The Dora was launched in 1880, operated by Alaska Commercial. It hauled marine mammal furs, later sold to the Alaska Steamship Company. Served the coastal trade. It was called the Bulldog of the North Pacific, the title due to the conditions it operated under. The Fish and Wildlife Service noted on its final demise that it was probably the most historic vessel in Alaska waters. They had rescued many ships during sinkings. They survived. They hit an iceberg in 1899. They survived a storm which so badly damaged the ship that it was left adrift for 63 days in 1906 and feared loss. After its encounter with the Nova Rupta events in 1912, it was blown aground near Seward and grounded for 3 weeks. It was refloated and repaired in Seattle. Finally, after a 40-year career, the good ship ran aground on Noble Island near Port Hardy, B.C., and the 10 of the crew was rescued out of 29, the ship sank. So unfortunately, it had a rough career.
Well, boy, and they call it a bulldog.
Exactly.
Well, I'd call it a bullseye.
You would think so. I wouldn't imagine they had an insurance company that would really rush to sell them a policy.
No.
June 1st, seismicity began. Earthquakes were felt at Katmai Village for at least 5 days prior to the eruption. There were no seismic instruments, though, within 1,000 kilometers of Katmai, and the earthquakes were not recorded until the first of many, starting at 8 minutes after 5 a.m. on 6th of June, before the magnitude got enough the early stations could pick them up. On 4th of June, severe earthquakes were felt at Kanatak, Oyak, Nushagak, and Katmai Village. The only two families present at Katmai Village evacuated, paddled down the coast toward Cold Bay. It was inferred that their departure was prompted by the earthquakes. By June, most Katmai residents were actually away at Kaflia Bay and Cold Bay, fishing either privately or as employees of commercial fish camps. Most were probably at Cold Bay when the eruptions took place, which is why the evacuees would have went that way. On 5th of June, there were severe earthquakes felt again at the same location. On the 6th in the morning, explosions were reported, but only at Nushagak and Seldovia, quite a long way away.
Yeah.
But, you know, sound is an odd thing, the way it carries with temperature layers.
And across water.
And mountains and so forth. So, yeah, I think that a place as close as Kodiak didn't hear it, but Seldovia did. At Seldovia, they later became louder and more frequent, continuing all day. At least 8 earthquakes with a magnitude of 4.8 to 5.5 were recorded remotely, and then in 1992 with more modern computers, all of those records were plotted out, and we know pretty much where now where all of the seismic centers were. That was between 8 minutes after 5 and 12:29, 12:30 noon. The first sighting of the eruption plume began at around 1300. There was a huge explosion and earthquake, which were reported at Cold Bay. The mail steamer Dora viewed the eruption cloud right at 1300 at 1 o'clock, immediately after hearing a detonation. The captain reported that the Dora had left Oyak at 8:30, steamed up Shelikov Strait in fine, clear weather, seeing no plume until entering Kaprianov Strait at 1. And then he saw a heavy cloud of smoke over Mount Katmai, 55 miles behind them. So certainly a lot of material was being thrown in the air by that time. When it was first seen, it was an immense column, 6/10 of a mile in diameter. It was soon obscured by the ash cloud expanding above it. The ash cloud was overhead by between 3 and 4. Ash began to fall on the ship around 1800, and the vessel was totally enveloped in darkness by 6:30. The ash raised the temperature on the deck. The heavy, sultry, dust-filled air became stifling, and rather than risk landing at Kodiak, McMullen did the right thing. He headed out to open sea. He said that thunder and lightning had begun early in the afternoon and that helpless birds of all species kept falling on the deck, floundering and crying wildly. There were a couple of prospectors out, and one prospector was mentioned that he had his dogs with him, and the birds, when the ash fall started, were so afraid they would run over and hide under the dogs. Absolutely, you know, anything that didn't have ash was a good point to be. At 1500, an explosion was heard for hundreds of miles around and as far as Juneau and Fairbanks. Detonations were first noted at 7 p.m. at Cordova. But interestingly, as early as 14:30, so 2:30 in the afternoon at Chicken, where they continued till about 6 the next morning.
So all the way to the Canadian border, just about.
Yes.
Wow.
And
In the interior.
Right. That sound came over the Alaska Range.
Yeah. That's about 800 miles.
It is. And you just can't imagine what it must have sounded like if you had had the misfortune of being close.
Well, true.
There were no explosions, interestingly enough, during any of this time recorded at Kodiak, even during the interval right before the ash cloud came. So at 4 in the afternoon, Captain K.W. Perry, aboard the Revenue Service Cutter Manning, who was already moored at Kodiak, observed a peculiar-looking cloud slowly rising to the southward and westward. Soon distant thunder was heard, and by 5, light ash began falling at that location and grew severe by 6 p.m., gradually increasing throughout the evening. The weather was fair. The ash began unexpectedly. Kodiak is not considered to be in a volcanic zone, and most of the ones to the north were thought to be totally dormant at that point. Their locations, as well as Kodiak, had no idea where the ash had originated until the reports from the Dora began to circulate. Many still disbelieved the origin could have been Katmai. One of the things that was interesting in Katmai, as usual with a ash cloud, there's a lot of static electric and a lot of lightning. Well, one of the first things hit in Kodiak was the wireless station, which burned to the ground. So news was unable to get out of Kodiak at that time.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a break here. I'm going to have some bumper music for you, some Aerosmith, and I do approve this bumper music. Then we're going to go into some Fox News, some state news, some commercials and weather, and we will be back.
Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at
News, I'm John Saucier. The U.S. Justice Department indicting former Cuban President Raul Castro in connection with the 1996 murders of four people. Three U.S. citizens were killed by Cuban fighter jets while flying civilian aircraft. The DOJ alleges the former leader had spies in Florida that gave intel on the Americans who were killed. Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche.
Today, we are announcing an indictment charging Raul Castro and several others with conspiracy to kill U.S. nationals.
The current Cuban president is responding, accusing the United States of lying and manipulating the events from 1996. We heard from President Trump today, says he wants the Strait of Hormuz reopened.
We're going to give this one shot. I'm in no hurry. You never think, oh, the midterms, I'm in a hurry. I'm in no hurry. Ideally, I'd like to see a few people killed.
America's listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
The Anchorage Daily News reports Kelly Hunt, the missing teen whose remains were found down a wooded embankment in Anchorage last month, died of hypothermia, police said Monday. The whereabouts of the 19-year-old had been unknown for months until she was found dead in the Spinard neighborhood on April 20th. Days later, the Anchorage Police Department confirmed that Hunt's remains had been found on the 3500 block of Lois Drive, but didn't say how they believe she died. In an interview Monday, Anchorage Police Chief Sean Case said the state medical examiner office determined that Hunt died due to hypothermia. Alcohol intoxication and extreme cold weather also contributed to her death, he said. The high temperature the day she went missing was 1 degree, with the low dropping to minus 11, according to the National Weather Service. Case said the medical examiner's investigation revealed no signs of trauma. The circumstances and manner of Hunt's death are still being investigated, Case said. Police hope to have more answers for Hunt's family within a couple of weeks.
Streaming live online at KFAR660.com.
It's summertime in Fairbanks. Time to take care of winter's damage, like those trees leaning dangerously towards your house or car. That's unsettling. It's time to call Eric and his crew at the Great Alaska Tree Company. Licensed, bonded, insured, and professional. Great Alaska Tree Company are the ones to call to get the job done and done right. And it's more affordable than you would think. And one less thing to worry about. They'll haul them away, cut them up, whatever you wish.
Hi, this is Eric with Great Alaska Tree Company. Call me for a free estimate for your year-round and emergency service at 978-4702.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I have Nick Nugent in the studio here with me, and we're looking at the earthquake eruption volcanic activity of 1912.
Yep, the creation of the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. You know, you can go there now. And they have the National Park Service puts on a very excellent tour of the area and have a lot of interpretive material. So if you like to go to someplace really remote and see a worldwide event, it's a good place to go.
Wow.
Well.
Yeah, three mountains are gone.
They are.
I mean, three.
So by 7 that evening, all of the ship and all other wireless communication was gone because of the amount of static in the air. One of the naval officers reported that ball lightning was running around all over the ground, terrifying most people who had never seen the phenomena before. Thunder and lightning finally diminished about midnight, but continued intermittently till the 8th of June, when the fallout finally ceased. The Woody Island station was destroyed by fire, which I'd mentioned a minute ago. At 5 minutes till midnight, the first major earthquake, which was a 6.5, was recorded after 11 hours of eruptings. At least eight other instrumentally recorded events had taken place during that time. This was soon followed at 35 minutes past midnight by earthquakes of magnitude 6.3 to 6.1. So the big quakes were starting. This is probably when the caldera was collapsing. The native families who evacuated Katmai Village on the 4th of June were camped ashore near Cape Kubakakli at the start of the eruption. When they arrived at Cold Bay there, they showed people rice-sized pumice in their boat, And they reported to have seen the top of Katmai Mountain blown off. That may be unlikely. That was probably an exaggeration. There's not a lot of evidence that shows that. So the ashfall dispersal from Nova Rupta directly across Mount Katmai and the timing of the collapses kind of don't add up to what some of the eyewitness accounts were.
Yeah.
There was a fourth-hand report. I don't know what that means. When something's
someone who told someone who told someone who might have seen something.
There you go. That's exactly it. They reached George Martin months later, said that the residents of Sovanovsky had paddled away at the start of the eruption, and on reaching Naknek, reported the upper half of the mountain was gone. So that was not an uncommon report, regardless. Their timing of their trip is kind of poorly known, and what they actually saw, it's interesting because Mount Katmai wouldn't have been visible from Sovanovsky.
What gets me on this, no loss of life.
None. There was one related death.
Yeah.
Later, a woman who had a pre-existing condition of asthma died because she basically went into a panic and overtaxed her abilities.
Yeah.
So that leads me up to something, Dave. I'll read this newspaper article from the Bakersfield, Californian, June 8th, 1912. And on one column it says, an Alaska volcano, violent eruption, earthquake. No deaths on the Alaska. Now, the column next to it.
I'm looking at this and this cracks me up. Now, Fairbanks, listen closely.
The column next to it. So the headline is 25 are killed in fight over a card game. Dateline, Nashville, Tennessee, June 8th. A special from Johnson City says 25 men were killed at Dante, Virginia, a mining town, in a fight started over a card game. Miners and mountaineers were arrayed against each other. It was reported that the dead men were Italians and mountaineers living in Dante. The fight is said to have engaged when the Italians charged the mountaineers with trying to cheat them at cards. Pistols were brought into play, and practically every man in the game is said to have lost his standards.
Wow.
So I think that's kind of interesting. Here in Alaska, our population is so low.
You can have the third largest event in the history of the world.
No one's injured.
Yeah.
And a card game.
And no one really knows about it.
And a card game in West Virginia totally overtaxes the Undertaker.
Wow.
Well.
he made a profit that day.
I think so. Well, on the 7th, ashfall began further away, Port Graham and Seldovia at the end of the Kenai Peninsula. Ash still was falling out at Kodiak. The Dora cleared the black smoke at around 4:30 in the morning, emerging into this fiery red haze, which eventually turned yellow. By 6 in the morning, the ashfall ceased and the horizon was clear from west to north. At one point, the captain reported they had shoveled over 16 inches of ash off the deck of the ship.
Wow.
So really an amazing ashfall. People from Kodiak in that morning took shelter on the revenue cutter Manning and in a warehouse near the wharf. The warehouse was a good choice. It was a metal building, so it was not flammable. The number rose the next day as people straggled in to 835, others coming from other vessels, a salmon cannery and Woody Island. Ashfall resumed that same day, though, at Kodiak, increasing in density until by 2 in the afternoon it was again pitch dark and remained so for the next 24 hours. It was fine dust and flakes of a yellowish color and a lot of sulfurous fumes. Now, at this time, birds and animals out, particularly birds, were killed off in great numbers. And a lot of dogs suffered from the acid rain. The acid rain was bad enough during this that it would burn the skin and damage buildings as far away as Valdez and Latouche Island. Mining buildings, the metal buildings, had damage to their metal skins. At one point, visibility was less than 50 feet, and a pilot couldn't see enough to put to sea. The only source of fresh water was from the condensers on board the Manning, which, of course, they were running as hard as they could. Many people begin to wonder if they were going to share the fate of Pompeii. Captain Perry took charge, and fortunately, the military was there. He prevented total panic, and the local saloon owners cooperated to help prevent a drunken panic, which would have been worse. There was no dawn on the 8th. The darkness was so total at times, men clearing the deck of the ship ran into each other. The crew was having trouble reading the compass on the Dora because of the ash was beginning to affect the instruments. The dining area, everything was covered with a thick layer of ash, and the temperature rose quite rapidly till it became stifling outside. At noon, ash began near Cordova. Well, on the 8th of June, we'll kind of keep moving along here, more of the same. This poor ship, the Dora's in and out of these clouds of volcanic ash. They were on their way to Seward, having stopped under clear conditions at Saldovia at 2 a.m., and they continued on until 4 when the ship emerged from the ash into brilliant clear weather. Ashfall finally, on the 8th, began to decrease at Kodiak. The skies were, of course, just bizarre red colors. It was almost ceased by late afternoon, and Martin, one of the researchers, attributed the top of the, located the second ash layer by that amount. So the ash was about 4.5 inches thick, but there are places where they know that the ash layers ran 6 to 10 feet. So it was way more than you could handle. There was an 18-hour lull. Earthquakes resumed less energetically then on the 9th. A very dense cloud of smoke came into Saldovia at 3 a.m. on the 9th, and ash fell till about noon. A few hours of partial darkness, and again, that was sort of the pattern of the 9th. As the wind would change, the ash clouds would change and move. So the only death, Ann Olson, an elderly refugee who was already suffering from tuberculosis and asthma, died aboard the Manning. She was the only death attributable to the 1912 eruption. On the 10th, three pretty good earthquakes took place. And on the 11th of June, ash and dust was noted at Dawson, Vancouver, Victoria, and layers around Puget Sound. Eventually, ash was noted in London by some of the better instruments in the area. It was in Wisconsin on the 8th of June, and Algeria. A weather station there was picking up the ash by the 19th of June. California on the 21st, and a number of European locations on the 20th to 27th. So the ash was worldwide. In Saldovia and Cordova, acid rain caused painful burns, killed vegetation, corroded the metal on buildings, and tarnished brass on all of the ships around. And that took place as far away as Puget Sound.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. You're listening to KFAR Radio. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Going camping is the simply satisfying, relaxing way to enjoy the Alaskan outdoors. Plan to get the most out of your experience with a visit to Frontier Outfitters. Check off your list of essentials such as tents, sleeping bags, and cookware from your favorite brands such as Mountain Hardware, Kelty, Slumberjack, Coleman, Jetboil, and more. Garmin GPS. Protect your eyes with sunglasses by Oakley, Maui Jim, and Costa. Your successful camping trip begins at Frontier Outfitters. Frontier Outfitters, for your Alaskan lifestyle.
KFAR Radio is proud to bring you 50-50 Friday. Every Friday at 9 a.m., log on to our website for a half-price offer from a local business. Great deals on restaurants, stores, shops, services, sporting events, and more. It's 50-50 Friday. This week's offer?
The Hungry Robot is your 50-50 Friday offer this week. Chicken Bacon, Spicy Islander, Bogan, Buffalo Blue, Pepperoni, Supreme, J-Popper, and more. Taste their wood-fired brick oven passion for pizza. Crispy, chewy, perfection. All half price for 50-50 Friday. Across from Mattress Ranch on the Old Stees, look for the big wood-fired copper ovens. Visit thehungryrobot.com for their online menu. Pickup and delivery. The Hungry Robot, named one of Guy Fieri's top six favorite pizzerias.
So log on to KFARradio.com this Friday morning starting at 9 a.m. for this awesome half-price offer. But hurry, as this deal will go fast. It's 50-50 Friday from KFAR.
Weather brought to you by The Woodway. Care for your lawn and garden with outdoor power equipment by Honda, Husqvarna, Steel, and more. The Alaskan way, the right way, The Woodway.
KFAR Weather.
Cloudy today with a slight chance of rain showers. Highs level off around 63. Southeast winds around 5 miles per hour. Cloudy again tonight. Chance for showers. Lows level off around 45. Cloudy skies with a few peaks of sun tomorrow. Slight chance for showers. High temperatures reach up to 63. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. We have in the studio here Nick Nugent giving us a history lesson of the great volcanic eruption on the Alaska Peninsula in June of 1912.
Yes.
114 years ago.
Yes.
I can do math, babe, barely with my fingers and toes. But my God, most people don't know about this event.
I don't think so. They understand the Valley of 10,000 Smokes, maybe have heard of that. They know there are some occasional volcanic eruptions and plumes that can be seen from Anchorage. For some reason, this is another of those stories that we, being interested in these things, kind of read and look and go, how is this forgotten?
Loss of life, no loss of life.
I think that was the biggest part.
Yeah.
And that's interesting that with loss of life, the Iditarod Pioneer, June 15th, 1912, has a huge headline, Many Lives Lost in Big Earthquake.
Yeah.
Well, if you read the article, you notice they don't mention numbers or where those were. But that headline, I can guarantee you, in Iditarod, would have sold a lot more newspapers.
Sounds like Mr. Hearst.
Just a little bit. The eruptive events, smoke clouds, went on until August. They appear to have not been seen very much after August. Of course, it was starting to get dark at night by that time. Could have been part of it.
Yeah.
On September 20th, the last major earthquake was recorded. After the eruption, earthquakes were felt at Cold Bay on 50 of the next 70 days. They were on the 11th and 21st of June and the 30th of July. Only one instrument really caught one, and that was one on the 17th, a 6.2 event. That was the final seismic event that one of the later researchers in 1992 was able to relocate and make this sort of a pattern of what was happening. Some of these earthquakes lasted a minute to a minute and a half, which when you're in one seems like a very long time. And they would see, one of the observers described it not so much as continuous plumes, but it reminded him of the chuffing of a locomotive out of the area about every 2 to 3 minutes.
Hmm.
Well, Ivan Orlov wrote his wife, Tanya, from Katmai, from Kodiak, and told her that they were awaiting death at any minute, but do not be alarmed. He notes there was no water, as all was mixed with ash, and the ash was 6 to 10 feet deep. Lightning cracked about every minute, adding to the kind of miserable, disorienting conditions. The fact all survived shows that the population of Kodiak were fairly hardy people. They weren't just, it wasn't like this happened and landed on Seattle with a bunch of urbanites.
No.
So as we go away from Katmai, more records are available, but of course, being further away, they don't tell us as much. The university at the observatory at the University of Washington and George Washington University became active and were tuned and really got all of the seismic record that was available for the rest of the event. Again, these explosions on the 7th were heard at Fairbanks and Chicken, 500 and 600 miles distant, and at even in Dawson City, 650 miles away. Juno was probably the furthest at 750. There were a lot of acidic rains from Seward to Latouche, damaging a lot of things. The steamer, Camason, logged ash 100 miles from Vancouver on June the 12th. So that's it was moving fairly quickly. And if you think about the height and the winds aloft, that's not too unexpected. The amount of dust blocked the solar energy reaching the Earth to the point 1912 was known as a year without a summer. Direct sunlight passed through a magnifier would a couple of people tried at one of the observatories. Direct sunlight passed through a magnifier would barely scorch brown paper. So under your maximum conditions,
yeah.
It just wasn't there. On June 8th, a high altitude cloud was noted in Madison, Wisconsin, Virginia 2 days later. An observation station, which had been set up in Algeria to measure solar radiation, noticed the same haze June 19th, and it remained there for the rest of that year. So a second station at Mount Wilson observed the haze. The two measured a depletion of solar radiation between 11 and 29%. So one-third of the solar radiation was gone. The heat held by the haze, the net was about a 10% diminishment in temperatures. It was an amazing thing. One estimate proposed that the amount of water released by this would have been 300 million tons in the form of steam.
Wow.
So that's really pretty much what we have. It was a remarkable event. It had worldwide consequences. Animals took a real beating, particularly it seems like most of the animal deaths reported, the animals have been blinded by the acidic rains.
Yeah. Ready for a phone call?
Sure.
Good morning. You're on KFAR Radio, and your name is?
This is Mel.
Hello, Mel.
I hope you don't mind me calling in toward the end here, but I want to bring Katmai up to date a little bit. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to go there twice. And it's a great, I have a lot of visitors up here, and it's a great bucket list site for visitors. Truly remarkable site. You mentioned the tour to Valley of 10,000 Smokes. I've flown in over it. I haven't gone on the tour, but friends have, and it's very nice. And it's just a spectacular park, and the Park Service manages it very well. And unfortunately, when I went, I was poor, but could still afford it. Now that I'm much better off, I can't afford it. So
it's gotten popular.
It's an expensive trip, and I've never applied for the McNeil River bear thing. But at Brooks Falls, is the one that you see on all the posters. The bears catching salmon.
In their mouth. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's there, and it's even on webcam and on explore.org, so live. So anyway, I just want to put a word in for Katmai that it's very much worth visiting, and you can take the tour to 10,000 folks and you can fly it over if you got a cooperative pilot. So anyway.
Appreciate the phone call. When did you go there?
Oh, gosh. I went in the 80s, and then I went again in 2000.
That's the thing about it. More people might go there now, but the contours of how it is now hasn't changed since you were there.
No, it hasn't. And it's really, you know, it's so varied. I like to fish. I'm a freshwater fisherman more than a saltwater fisherman. And the fishing's great. And, you know, rainbows are huge and all that. And the salmon, you know, you can catch them right there where the bears walk by. You know, they were going to move the campground, you know, further away from the bears, which they should have done, but they still haven't. But it's still a great place. I buy camping. I can't afford the lodge. But anyway.
Not many people can. Don't think you're alone.
it's for a bucket list for visitors. Anybody that hasn't been and has visitors coming, go there together. It's a great place. So.
Hey, appreciate the phone call, Mel. You have a great week. Talk to you later. Bye. Yeah.
He used to work in King Salmon in the winter of mid-80s. Company I worked for, we based our sea ice monitoring out of there back in the old days when the sea ice came down a bit further south.
Ah.
And there were some people who were looking ahead and starting to build up, realizing that King Salmon's got a very good airport,
mm-hmm.
and they were starting to build up fly-in trips into the whole national park area. And Mel's talking about fishing. One of the areas that got a lot of fishermen was Ugashik Lake.
Yeah.
And they would usually fly in there from King Salmon. King Salmon actually has, you wouldn't think, right on Bristol Bay, but it has more clear days than Anchorage in the winter.
I believe it. So what's next on your list of thoughts for presentation?
We'll be doing Stepakov, who was known as the Russian Lindbergh. He was here in Fairbanks several times. He was involved in the Russian side of the search for Ben Eielson, and he was lost on a record-setting attempt from Moscow to Fairbanks.
Wow.
Then in July, we'll have Mike Gibson coming in. Mike's worked with the Purdy family and has gone over a lot of their grandparents' diaries, which are very well written. And right in time for Golden Days, we'll get kind of a nice look at early mining up around Chicken and in the 40-mile country.
What's your plans for the 3-day weekend?
Ooh.
You know, the thing that happens, well, you're retired, so every day is a 3-day weekend.
It is.
Jerk.
retirement, it's just amazing how quick you can get used to that. I see the look.
I'm giving him a hard look. A hard look.
I probably shouldn't mention that I barely remember there's such a thing as 5 a.m.
I remembered it this morning, and I rolled over.
I don't know what we'll do. I guess with everything coming up, have a little bit of house things to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, our yard is kind of ugly this spring. I don't know.
I got to get mine raked.
Yeah,
I got to get mine raked. It'll probably be Sunday or Monday, get mine raked up and get it ready to go. You know, it's been a late happening spring. Of course, we had a hard, long winter, so what the heck?
It's been amazing. We were in Spokane last week, and it actually got down into the 40s there after having been in the 80s. It followed us.
Now, Fairbanks, I don't want to piss you off, but here's the deal. Since we had a long, hard winter, and we had a late happening spring going into summer, now they have smoke fire warning, so we're just going to get smoked out here in about a week.
You just wonder about some years. You kind of think that maybe the Visitor and Convention Center should do a better job for us.
Fairbanks, that is our show for today. Greatly appreciate you listening to us. And on Friday, I'll have Representative Mike Prox calling in from Juneau to tell us all about this special session and what they accomplished and all the things they did not accomplish. We'll see you on Friday.